Morning, everyone. The panel has before it, of course, two cases for argument this morning, namely Appeal Number 06-5051, Cienega Gardens v. United States, and Appeal Number 06-5052, Chancellor Manor v. United States. As you can see, the court has assembled an enlarged panel, which is statutorily permitted, and among other reasons, we wanted to be able to involve the judges who were on the last three-judge panels that heard these respective appeals. For the benefit of all counsel in both cases, we may expect that you'll have 20 minutes per side rather than the normal 15. Beyond that, we may, through the force of questioning, run over even that period. In no event will reserve rebuttal time of either appellant be diminished, so the full 5 minutes reserved through our courtroom deputy and the clerk's office will be awarded regardless of the length of the questioning. I hope that's clear enough to everybody. Mr. Dintzer, welcome. Good morning. Please proceed.
May it please the court. The trial court failed to undertake the sweeping analysis required by the Penn Central test and instead applied a truncated approach to each prong of that test, which caused the court to reach the wrong conclusion regarding the plaintiff's staking claim. Turning first to the character prong, in considering the character of the government action, the
can you help us out with the standard of review on these three Penn Central factors? Is there a clearly established standard of review for an appellate panel on those three factors?
We believe, Your Honor, that it's a de novo review regarding the legal aspects of it, which is...
That's kind of circular. What are the legal aspects and what are the factual aspects so that we can apply the appropriate standard?
The framing of the tests is legal. How should the question... Basically, the question that is asked, whether it's the character prong or any of the other prongs, the framing of it is what you're looking for. That's a legal standard. Then the factual finding on whether they met that is obviously based on factual findings.
Well, how about with regard to the severity of the economic impact? Is the selection by the trial judge in this case from between two competing models offered by the two sides a question that we review de novo or for clear error or for abuse of discretion or what?
The court should review it de novo, Your Honor. The court...
Wait a minute. Based on what authority?
Based on I would compare it to, in the damages context, when the selection of the damages model, the DACO case, selection of the model is a legal question.
Well, I read in your brief the citation to DACO, but of course that's a contract case, not a takings case. And in that case, where we focused on reasonableness, that seems to me to translate most naturally or correlate most naturally with the abuse of discretion standard. So to say that something's reviewed de novo but for reasonableness is self-contradictory. If it's reviewed for reasonableness, it seems to me that suggests that there are several possible proper answers and the trial judge has some range of discretion to choose from alternatives, let's say A, B, and C. Well, that's not de novo. That's the opposite of de novo. That's highly deferential. So I'm lost. To the extent you're depending on DACO, I have a lot of trouble following that.
Okay. Well, Your Honor, stepping back then and just taking a look at the question that is asked, what the court wants to do, presumably, is to create a test whereby similarly situated plaintiffs will come into court and be treated the same. What we have, if the trial court can pick the standard, the test which to apply, not only how to apply it, but if it can pick the test, then you'll have two similarly situated plaintiffs walk into adjoining courtrooms and walk out with different answers.
Well, that might not be so bad, because it may be that in one case, the facts needed to drive Model A in the choice of A versus B wouldn't be available, whereas in another case, the facts needed to utilize Model A would be available. So obviously, in that kind of a circumstance, a different model would be chosen in one case versus the other because of the data that's available.
Your Honor,
there's nothing inherently unfair or wrong about that, is there?
Well, it depends, Your Honor. It depends on the circumstances. Speaking more concretely, what we have here is we have, in this case, the trial court picked one approach. In the CityLine case, where the plaintiffs are alleging the same type of claim and bringing in the same type of evidence, the trial court concluded that the change in value, that applied the change in value approach.
But the problem that I'm having is that the parties differ to a great extent on the effect of the statutes that we're dealing with here, and the interpretation of those statutes, which presumably is a legal question. And I think that both sides don't do the kind of job that they should in explaining how these statutes operate. And, you know, they're complicated statutes, and there's a real difference between it. You say that the effect of the statutes is to allow the initiation of a process 2 years before, which can culminate in a sale at fair market value, either to a qualified purchaser or after 15 months to somebody else. And the other side takes a different view of those statutes. Those kinds of issues are presumably legal issues about statutory interpretation here as to what the statute means, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And one of the things that they say is that you couldn't complete this sale process until a long time after the prepayment date of the mortgages. You say that you can complete the sale process by initiating the process 2 years before the prepayment date, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And they say, no, there's a provision in the statute which says that the fixed rents will continue for 3 years after the prepayment date, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what's the answer to that? It seems to me that the statute talks about 3 years for low vacancy areas and special needs people. How has the secretary interpreted that?
I don't have an answer for you, Your Honor. I don't know if that portion has been interpreted. There's nothing in this record by either party about the interpretation. But what I can say is that if they do prepay, I mean, the Park Ridge Investors case, for example, looked at this and said, look, they want one of two things. Either they can get out of the program, and albeit there is a delay in raising rents, they can still prepay and they can still start moving to market rents.
Well, your theory is that they can prepay the mortgage, as I understand the way the time schedule works, they can prepay the mortgage 1 month after the original prepayment date.
Your Honor, it's not locked in stone. If they start 2 years in advance, it's approximately a two-year process. Sometimes it can take a little longer. And so if they start 2 years in advance, they can presumably pay right at the prepayment date or shortly thereafter.
So your theory is they're not restricted at all if they begin the two-year process 2 years before the prepayment date.
They shouldn't be. If the process goes the way it should, then they should not be. They should be able to prepay. But, Your Honor, the process, there's. I just want to clarify to make sure that the court understands. There's the statute allows two ways out. One of them is if you meet the statutory standard, you file a plan of action under the 4108, and you say, we meet the statutory standard, and you prepay and you leave.
Yeah, but the judge found that was futile, that wouldn't work.
For these plaintiffs, that is the case.
So put that aside. Okay. Put that aside.
Putting that aside, then there's the second way, which is you go through the 4114 process, and that process is either you seek a use agreement or a sale. And if the government does not fund a use agreement before you sign it, if they say, well, we're not going to do that, or if there's not a buyer on the sale prompt, then you wait 15 months to see, and then you leave. You can exit the program. There are some restrictions after you end the program.
And your theory is that could happen on or about the original prepayment date.
Yes, Your Honor.
Were there any findings by the trial court about the feasibility of accelerating the process so that the approximately two-year process would be over as of the prepayment date at 20 years?
The court didn't make specific findings about that. He did find that it was, that especially in the Los Angeles office, that there were certain delays and that it might take longer than 2 years.
Yeah, but the question isn't whether it's exactly 2 years or 2.5 or 1.5. The question is, can somebody start correspondingly early enough that they can be reasonably assured that the process will be finished by the original 20-year prepayment date?
Yes, Your Honor. There was testimony to the court about that.
But no findings.
What the court, for the length of how much time, I don't believe the court made specific findings for these plaintiffs about how long it would have taken them, no. Because the court did not look at the length of time that...
So you're asking us, in line with Judge Dyke's question, you're effectively asking us to find that there was no diminution in value under any measure for he who was alert and started the process 2 years or so in advance, and therefore any harm was self-inflicted, therefore no liability for the government, right?
In a sense, Your Honor, what we're saying...
But that argument is based on an assumption of a set of facts as to which we have no findings, and as I recall, very little evidence.
Your Honor, the sale option, we put in evidence about the sale option. The plaintiffs did. The statute is you can sell under the preservation process. The plaintiffs
That's not what's disputed. The question is whether you can start the process 2 or 3 years early so that it will reliably be finished as of the original 20-year prepayment date. It looks to me like on that you have no findings, explicit or implicit, and very little evidence.
The record shows at A103237 the testimony of the sale took approximately 2 years or a bit more, Your Honor. At A103239, under Title VI, owners could file 2 years in advance. It is in the record that they could meet these benchmarks. The point is the availability of the sale option makes it so that under the Conti case and under Florida Rock, the availability of being able to sell at market value diminishes any other economic impact. In Conti, the plaintiff came in and said, look, your drift net regulations have cost me the value of my fishing boat.
But you're talking about availability to sell at the diminished market value under the restraint.
No, Your Honor. Right? The property is valued under the statute. The property is valued as if there's no restraint.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking. But who is going to buy at that market value when they also have to accept the restraint on rents?
Well, Your Honor, because HUD financed the buyers, 95% of the buyer of the money that the buyers came in with came from the taxpayers. There were always people who wanted to buy.
But the answer is that once you go through the sale process, you're free and clear of all restrictions once you can sell, except for the 3-year provision that we were talking about earlier, right?
There are some restrictions after the sale, Your Honor.
Which restrictions?
There are limits on the ability to raise rent on the people in place after the sale.
For three years. But that's only in low vacancy areas. But apparently nobody's explored what the effect of that provision is, right?
That is true, Your Honor. Plaintiffs have the burden of proving that we're proving everything in this case. So to the extent that the record is vacant on their proof as to exactly how that would have affected them financially, then that is a failure of proof on the plaintiff's part. In answer to Judge Newman's question, there were 37 sales identified by one witness just in the state of California. The testimony was that every person who went and looked for a sale, who chose that option, found a buyer. So it was not speculative to think that they would have been able to find somebody to buy the property.
So in that case, the injury would be the obligation, the forced sale, rather than the whatever the investment plans may initially have been in entering into this arrangement with HUD.
No, Your Honor.
The only way you can protect your investment at all would be to sell the property that you had expected to hold as a lessor.
No, Your Honor. The ability, respectfully, the ability to sell is a choice. You don't have to do it. But knowing that you can sell at market rate means that whatever else you do is your choice, because you could always turn around and sell at market rate. So there's no other economic impact, which is why the court in Conti and the court in Florida, they didn't even feel like they had to go and perform the rest of the economic impact.
So in your view, is that a matter of affecting the damages, or whether there is fundamentally a taking, which is actually behind us, is the law of this case?
It goes directly to the heart of the taking question, Your Honor. And both, in fact, the ability to sell and the entire preservation scheme that the court, that the government set up, that Congress set up, was completely ignored by the trial court in considering the character prong. It considered, the way it looked at it was, there's a moratorium, you can't prepay. It refused to look at the sale option. It refused to look at the use agreement option.
Well, you can't fault the trial court for following the instructions that it received for the remand to determine the injury.
Your Honor, these are not the model plaintiffs. They were not up here on Sienega Garden 8. And this is a
Of course,
grand.
But the reason there were model plaintiffs was so that we would not have to review the fundamentals for each property owner. It would be decided for the model plaintiffs.
Yes, Your Honor, but in the Sienega Garden 8 decision, the court recognized that it was addressing a limited, that the government had provided limited arguments and a limited record, and so the court said regarding future cases, to the extent that the government can demonstrate affirmative errors through reference to additional evidence and flaws in the arguments in future cases in which plaintiffs make the same arguments, this opinion should not be understood to bar future courts from also considering that evidence and those arguments.
Exactly, in terms of different circumstances, perhaps applying to different property owners. But you're saying that the fundamental principle of the taking, that decision was flawed for the model plaintiffs as well.
Well, Your Honor, we're not appealing the model plaintiffs, so I would say that, I mean, the government does believe that there wasn't a taking in those circumstances as well, but obviously that's not here on appeal. What we do believe, though, is that the court clearly identified in a number of caveats in that opinion that we have the right to come in with a fresh slate and make these arguments. The court did not consider, in that opinion, the sale option. The court
But you must show a distinction between the ensuing plaintiffs and the model plaintiffs. Is that so?
The distinction, Your Honor, is in the proofs, is in the fact that the court did not have a chance to consider what impact the sale option has. In fact, in the recent Independence Park decision, which was the model plaintiffs, that panel said expressly that, quote, at no point in that case, referring to Sienega Garden 8, did we discuss the 1995 use agreements or their effect on the plaintiff's legal rights. The Sienega Garden 8 didn't even consider the import of the use agreements. And we believe that the use agreements directly go to both the character prong, the fact that the government was making them available, and to the economic impact prong, none of which was considered by Sienega Garden 8.
But following up on Judge Newman's question with regard to the availability of a fair market value sale, that's an option.
Yes.
But that's not an option where I can keep the property and pay off the mortgage. That's a mandatory sale. That's the only way I can get out under the restriction.
No, Your Honor, respectfully, you can get out by going through the process, and if the government doesn't offer you a use agreement or if nobody comes through to buy, then you can get out that way.
But that's the alternative.
That is the alternative, but it's not a mandatory sale in the sense that you have the choice. The only thing that the Fifth Amendment protects, Your Honor, is the right to have the fair market value of your property. If we went in and we just took their property, the thing that the Fifth Amendment would protect is that they should receive the market value of the property. The fact that Congress made that available, and then other options too, that the character of the government action was trying to benefit and trying to avoid impacting the plaintiffs. The fact that we added other options should not be counted against the government.
But the first option is almost like a mandatory condemnation. We take the property through a sale to a third party, and we finance that sale.
I just balk at the word mandatory, Your Honor, and that it was always made a choice to the plaintiffs. If they wanted to get out, and they wanted, or the court needs to understand the nature of the use agreement just to understand what else they had, the option that they had. The use agreement was you sign an agreement, and all those restrictions that you felt during the first 20 years, they drop. The limit on paying dividends drops from what it used to be all the way down to zero if you choose. You can choose no more limitations on dividends. The limitations on rent increases. You sign the use agreement, rents go to market rate. You sign the use agreement, you can take out a loan against your property. The use agreement is provided extensive opportunities to reduce the regulation. So, yes, you did have the choice to sell. You also had the choice to sign a use agreement and drop the regulations and keep the property. Or you could continue on in the program as you had the past 20 years and wait for the mortgage to be paid off.
But under the use agreements, wasn't there still a limit on the rent you could charge to current tenants?
The way that they worked, Your Honor, was the rents were brought to market rent at that time. Going forward, yes, there were certain limitations on rents going forward. But the reduction in regulation brought about by the use agreement is significant.
I'm not questioning that you can say it's significant. The point is it's not total.
It is not total. It is not total, Your Honor. But if the court had... There are a number of errors with the approach taken by the trial court, the snapshot approach. One of which is...
What were the benefits that were given under the use agreement alternative? What were the benefits that were given to the owners?
Okay, I would characterize in two categories. One of the benefits was actual money, is Section 8 contracts with the plaintiffs. They got more Section 8, which means that the government funded more of their tenants. It meant that the more people could come in at the maximum rents, and basically it's more money. The other set of things is not benefit so much as a reduction in regulation. That was the ability to take out a loan against equity of millions of dollars, the ability to eliminate the dividend regulations, the ability to tax certain equity accounts in the property, and the ability to raise rents to market. And while, Your Honor, I agree that the market increases after you sign it are not necessarily as fast as market rents, they increased quite a bit faster than they had before. So we're talking about an escalation of rents that were quite significant. So the use agreement...
But if I'm out of the program, I go in an instant from controlled rent, let's say half the market rent, to 100% of the market rent the next day, right?
Well, not necessarily, because then everybody moves out. So you level that in. But when you go out of the program, you also face certain risks. If you drive the program, all of a sudden, instead of having a 1% HUD guaranteed mortgage, you're facing a regular market mortgage. Instead of having HUD providing Section 8 assistance, instead of having higher, low-income people who you know are lining up to live in your place, you have to compete against the conventional. Having a HUD property is a lower risk endeavor. That's why some plaintiffs have not prepaid even after all the restrictions were pulled away. In the model plaintiffs, Pico Plaza was one of the model plaintiffs. It never prepaid. All the restrictions were torn away. Could prepay any day. Has chosen not to. There's a real benefit. The government had people signing use agreements after HOPACT was passed.
I didn't want to jump in on you there in the middle of the sentence, but time is fleeting. Let me ask you. You argue that the Court of Federal Claims erred in using the return on equity approach. Correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Now, assume for the moment, and I realize you would disagree with the assumption, but assume for the moment that the return on equity approach was the correct approach. Okay.
Yes, sir.
What, if any, errors do you say there were in the court's application of that approach?
Okay. There would be two. Okay. Well, first, there would be the fact that it only applied the test once. Now, it's a snapshot approach, which means it takes a picture at one point in time.
No, but that's whether it's the right or wrong approach. You're getting back to your argument that it's the wrong approach. Assume it's correct to look at that snapshot, that period. What, and I realize you disagree with that, what errors do you see in application of that approach, which you say was wrong?
They didn't do it enough. They didn't do it enough times. If that's the right approach, you have to do it every year because the numbers in the model change year to year to year to year. And we know that. For example, the Fannie Mae rate, which is the 8.5%, that goes down each year. And the court only applied it at the very first year. So we know that it should have applied it, even if that's the right approach.
Well, then the answer is we should remand for further factual development. But in the end of your blue brief, you claim a right to have an outright reversal, page 71.
Well, I was starting from the premise that this test is the right one. If it is the right one, and if the court need not look at the changing value, then at a minimum, yes. But, Your Honor, if the court were to look at the changing value approach, which we believe is the correct approach, the court would find that the economic impact was as low as 12.9% for one.
So could it be that the trial judge should look at both models, consider both models, and presumably come up with some sort of intermediate figure?
At a minimum, we believe that the case law says you have to look at changing value. So yes, at a minimum, it has to look at that. If the court was going to look at an equity-based approach like the snapshot, it's still a bad approach, given that there would still be ways that it would have to be changed or fixed, even if it was going to be applied.
Isn't there an intermediate position between the two of you in the sense that they may be correct that the change in value approach is wrong because it doesn't really take account of the lost income? But isn't it possible that the correct approach is to look at the lost income and compare it to the overall value of the property?
Your Honor, if I could start with the beginning part of your question first.
Start with the end of it.
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
You don't believe so what?
I don't believe that an income approach would be the best.
That's not my question. Isn't there an intermediate position where you'd say, okay, what's the lost income? You calculate the lost income, and you compare that to the entire value of the property.
Yes, Your Honor. That would be the change in value approach.
No, it's not the change in value approach.
If you take the income, the way that you value a property at time X is you look at all the income, and you discount it back to a certain date. If you say, okay, what's it with the regulation, you say, how much income, so what our expert did is this.
I don't think you're understanding my question. The question is, in a temporary taking, you've lost the use of the property for a period of time, let's say a year, 2 years, 3 years, whatever it is, and you can calculate the lost income during that period.
Yes, sir.
Don't Penn Central and Tahoe suggest that you have to compare that lost value with the overall value of the property?
Yes. And if because those losses are in the future, you definitely have to discount so that you're talking about a correct time. And if you do that, effectively what you've got, you on is a change in value. Because if we value an apartment building for $1 million, that's based on what income.
No, that's not true. Under your approach, you're essentially saying that there's no economic impact because property values in general have increased during the period. But, you know, a change in value approach sometimes can yield a severe economic impact, but sometimes there's no economic impact because the values of property together with the market have gone up. And it seems unfair under those circumstances just to look and change in value because there's no loss as a result of the change in value. But they say, we could have rented it for a year, we could have rented it for 2 years, we lost that income. And that may be an appropriate approach sometimes, but don't you have to compare that to the overall value of the property so you're not stripping out some one strand?
To clarify, because the court is connecting two arguments. One is that we say under the snapshot approach, the court should have, but failed to, consider the rise in the value of the property. That is separate, Your Honor, from the changing value. We are not saying, and I think this is where the confusion is, we are not saying, you look at the value of the building on date A, and then you look at it on date B, and see if it changed. What our appraisal expert did, was this. He said the value of this building, as if there were no regulations at all, on day A would be this. Looking at the income, because there would be reduced income under the regulations, and we do acknowledge that, the value of the property under the regulations at that same date is lower. And then he says, what's the difference? And there is a difference. We do find a difference. And then we say, and then we do what the court is asking, which is we put the reduced amount over the original amount, and that's where we get the change in value. And that is, for example, Blossom Hill. 13.3% economic impact under change in value means that the regulations reduce the value of the building on the date of the initial taking by 13.3%. That is what our experts said. Now, we don't believe, under the case law of this court, that that is sufficient economic impact to support a taking. But it absolutely took into account every dollar of alleged lost income. In fact, we did the test a second time. We took the plaintiff's damage model. We said, okay, how much money do you think you lost? And from the model, the valuation of the property, and we did the same test. Okay, based on your own analysis, and in fact, their damage model produced lower economic impact than our expert.
Mr. Denson, excuse me again, I'm just trying to still understand what you said in response to my question. If one accepts the court's return on equity approach, which I didn't understand you say is wrong, what error was there in the court's application of that approach?
Beyond the fact that it only took it once, the court also refused.
When you say only took it once, what do you mean by that?
Well, if you think of a real snapshot, if you take a picture on one day and the people change, it's not an accurate picture. The court, the numbers that the court put into the model, the plaintiffs put into the model, were numbers from the very first year. But those numbers, the equity amount, the amount that the property made, and the Fannie Mae amount, those numbers changed from year to year. But we know that the snapshot—I mean, you can look—they've only—they only took one snapshot, and so that was—and after these properties signed a use agreement, the numbers changed dramatically.
Now, did you argue this below?
Absolutely not.
Is that where you cite to in your brief?
In
your reply brief, you come back and cite to a page in your post-trial briefing. Is that where you argued these points?
I believe so, Your Honor, but I'm quite confident we made these arguments. I mean, we spent quite a bit of time discussing the flaws in this test. And the reason that this taking it more than once, if it's the right test, is important is once they sign the use agreements significantly raise the rents, and they take out equity, so the equity drops substantially. And so all of a sudden, even under the snapshot approach, if it were applied after the use agreement, there wouldn't be enough economic impact to support a takings claim. That's why we asked the court, please look at after the use agreement as well. They wouldn't. And in fact, plaintiff's expert acknowledged that he didn't look at the numbers after they signed the use agreement.
But if you take a return on equity type of an approach, every single time you have a temporal taking, if you take the time period from, let's say, 1998 to 1996, during that time period, there was always a diminution of return on equity. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't
during the time period, the temporal taking between 1988 and 1996, that 8-year time period.
Yes, Your Honor.
If you look at it from a return on equity type of return, you're always going to have a lower return because of the restriction.
I don't know if that's true after they sign the use agreement.
No, wait. Without the use agreement, you always have a lower return on equity during that time period. So if you have even a, without a use agreement, at the end of the taking period, you would still go back to the original equity return, right? So during that time period, like we had in Tahoe, in Tahoe, there was a complete taking for a certain period of time. You couldn't develop the property at any time during the restriction on development. Now, if we had the same taking here, same type of a taking as we have in Tahoe, which would completely eliminate any development of the property or any income from the property, you would always have a taking under the theory of equity, return on equity. But at the end of that time period, if you use the proper denominator under Penn Central analysis, you would not have a taking because you would have a diminution, but not sufficient enough to meet the requirements of a regulatory taking.
Your Honor, respectfully, with respect to Tahoe Sierra, they concluded that you shouldn't apply a categorical test to the fact that there was a moratorium so that they couldn't develop for a few years, so they didn't find that there was a taking. What the trial court was concerned about was that when you have a temporary taking and they get the property back, it's going to be hard to show enough economic impact. The example it used is, you know, you could have a complete restriction for 4.5 years, then you get the property back, and you've only got 45% economic impact in that camp group of taking. The idea, first of all, that there's two problems with that, John. One is the idea of having an easier test for temporary taking is simply unfair to people who face permanent taking. It should be a uniform test. The snapshot approach produces numbers well over, can produce numbers well over 100%. It can't compete, those percentages can't be compared in any way to the change in value numbers. It's apples and oranges. But second, the idea that...
Now, are you saying that under a return on equity type of a test, you'd always have a taking?
It's not that you always would. Let's say you had a week where you couldn't open your business, and during that week, because the place next door had a fire and they wouldn't let you open your business for whatever reason, that would be 100% economic impact. It would just take a week. It would take a day because the test doesn't have a temporal element. It doesn't aggregate amount. So it would be very easy. I wouldn't say always, Your Honor, but I would say that with this test, it has become. I mean, this test would redefine what a taking is. It would be significantly easier than the 75-80% plaintiffs who lost 75% of the economic value of their property in prior cases and were sent away. You could lose a week's worth of pay. And I'll give you an example.
Well, Mr. Dinsel, let me pose this hypothetical. Isn't there a difference between say there's a 10-year leasehold and a government regulation extinguishes or puts a freeze on that leasehold for 2 years, 20% of the time? Is there a difference between that and a regulation that simply diminishes the overall value of the leasehold over the 10-year period by 20%?
Well, Your Honor, if you started with a leasehold, then obviously the number of sticks that you have in the basket are few. A regulation that limited that for 2 years would be the proper way to value it would be to value those 2 years versus the value of the entire leasehold. So it would be a change in value of whatever that is.
20%.
Presumably, although it might be more if you because of discount.
So seemingly, those situations are, from your perspective, the same.
Yes, Your Honor, and which I believe is what the court did in Tahoe Sierra. It said when you have a moratorium, the fact that it's a moratorium doesn't mean that we're going to weigh it differently. And in fact, most of the takings cases that this court and the Supreme Court have looked at, whether it's Meritrans or forest properties, what you're looking at is people going through a regulatory process, and while going through it, they are frozen. They can't cut their lumber. They can't fill in their wetlands. They can't, and during that time, they can't, you know, chop down trees and sell them, or whatever the business happens to be. But the court has always said, we will look at the property as a whole. And Bass Enterprises, and especially Siebert. Siebert was a temporary takings case in this court, a temporary denial of a logging permit. This court applied the change in value approach. And it said, that's the proper test. Because, I mean, quite honestly, first of all, if you applied a different test for a temporary permanent taking, several things would happen. One would be that there would be some times when what you're doing is incentivizing the government not to give the thing back. We could face, if you're going to have a different test between one and the other, it would say to the government, well, you face a harder test if you give it back. But, of course, the incentive that we want is if the government doesn't need it anymore, give it back, and then face whatever consequences you face.
But it seems to me that if that's the case, then in the real estate context, there would almost never be a taking if there was a temporary restriction of one sort or another, because you could almost assume that in most real estate contexts, the value of the property will always appreciate, and sometimes appreciate more than any temporary interference.
Well, the appreciation is the valuation of for a piece of property. Proper way to do the change in value approach typically is you look at the you measure it from the same date. So it's not what was it at the beginning versus what was it at the end. It's from the beginning time, what is it with the restriction, regulation, and what is it without? So if it would be an ex ante analysis. It would be at the time of the taking. But temporary takings are temporary. The whole idea of, the reason we do the economic impact prong, according to the Lingle case, the recent Lingle case, is you're looking for the functional equivalent of a physical taking. And when you're simply regulating, and Your Honor, I'll give you an example. Skyline View only faced a 12.9%, this is our measurement, change in value. The plaintiffs have it well over 90% under its test. You're talking about a plaintiff who faced just barely over 10% of a change in its overall value. But because there's this new test that produces very high numbers very quickly, the effect is to make it look much worse than it was.
Now, we've given you almost 18 minutes of additional time, so I think we better hear from the other side at this point.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Good morning. How are you?
Very well.
Please proceed, and you may, if you need it, considerably expand your argument.
Thank you, Judge Michel. May it please the court. I'd like to start off talking today about the sale option because I understand that there were some questions about precisely how the statute worked and how long we had to sell and whether we could have sold for fair market value. And then I'd also like to address how I think it ought to be viewed. Counsel for the government was correct that under Title VI, which is LIPRA, you could begin the process 2 years before your prepayment dates. But what he didn't tell you was that the regulations that were necessary for you to follow under LIPRA weren't enacted until April of 1992.
What difference does that make? The statute tells you what you can do, doesn't it?
Well, no, because you couldn't start the process until the regulations told you how. The government hasn't disagreed with us on that. The regulation set out in quite a lot of detail exactly what steps you should take, and there were no plans of action that were filed in process before the regs came out under Title VI. And for our properties, three of them, Cienega, the prepayment date was December of 91, so just 4 months beforehand. Del Amo was 1 month beforehand, March of 92. Las Lomas was July 15th. That was after the regs came out. So for those three properties, quite clearly, you couldn't even have started the process for a sale until about April of 92, give or take.
Was there testimony to that effect?
Yes, there was, Your Honor.
Who?
I'd have to... Carol Blodney, Your Honor, testified to that. So for those properties, if you take even the government's estimate of a two-year process, and I'll explain in a moment that that's wrong, but if you took that, then there would at least be a two-year gap between your prepayment date and when you could sell. Now, why it's wrong...
For those plaintiffs.
For those three. For those three. And those are the three, Your Honor, that signed use agreements and that have much more substantial damages than the other two, which are Lawsonville and Skyline.
But if you could sell and it would take you 2 years, you're just deprived of the use for 2 years, right?
You're deprived of more than that, Judge Dyke, in two ways. First of all, the appraisal date is going to precede much of that time period. So they appraise and then the process goes on to find a buyer, and then to go through the approval of your plan of action. So your appraisal date was going to be a couple of years before you actually sold. So if there was appreciation in the interim, you weren't going to get the benefit of that in your fifth sale price. So when the government talks about fair market value, even if one assumes that the process that they set up with the different appraisers coming together and meeting, et cetera, was a fair process, the process was still on a two-year lag. So you weren't going to get the value, whatever it was, 2 years.
Was there any evidence that there was a loss of value as a result of that? I thought the only evidence that you presented was lost income.
Well, Your Honor, we didn't present evidence of lost value for that because we didn't take the sale option.
No, but under the statute, the sale option was available. The question, in order to determine the economic impact of the taking, you have to consider the availability of the sale option and what that would do to the value of the property. And the government's contention is that under Tahoe, the court said that you must consider the impact of things like the sale option and the use agreements and factor that into the value in computing economic impact.
Your Honor, with due respect, I don't think that there was a holding in either Cienega or Chancellor Manor that the value of those items had to be taken into consideration.
No, I'm talking about the Supreme Court's decision in Tahoe. It says explicitly and that's the difference between the majority and the dissent. It says explicitly you have to take into account the overall value of the property and the impact of the regulation on the overall value.
Your Honor, I would agree that Tahoe said that for categorical takings, you've got to take into account whether what was taken from you in light of the lifetime value of the property, whether that took all of it. On the other hand, when the court, first of all, the court quite expressly said it wasn't ruling about partial regulatory takings, and it sent the case back for Penn Central analysis. Further, the court said that it might be that you should be particularly skeptical of any moratorium that lasts for more than a year. Now, if the court meant to say that you have to look at the change in value approach and you're talking about real estate, a one-year moratorium would not raise particular eyebrows because 1 year out of a 50 or 100-year useful life.
I'm not understanding. The Supreme Court says explicitly, district court erred when it disaggregated petitioner's property into temporal segments corresponding to the regulations at issue and then analyzed whether petitioners were deprived of all economically viable.
And I agree with that.
So, why would you treat it in determining economic impact any differently when you've got a Lucas situation or when you've got a Penn Central analysis?
I think there's good reason to do so, Your Honor. First of all, any of these tests that we're applying are, of course, only ways to try to figure out whether what the government has done meets the Armstrong test. And the court has been quite clear that we don't rely on set formulas. And so different contexts are going to have perhaps different rules. The reason why in a categorical takings case, I think it's quite important, the court correctly recognized that a categorical takings case, if you took the period of the temporary taking and that's all you looked at, then any moratorium, no matter how long or how short, any complete moratorium was going to be 100% taking and therefore categorical and therefore the government would have to pay. And the court recognized that not every situation like that is one where, in justice and fairness, the burden has to be put on society as a whole. When you're looking instead under the Penn Central factors, you have other factors you can look at as well. You can look at the character of the taking, and you can look at reasonable investment-backed expectations.
Not can, must.
Must, Your Honor. And so, given that you look at those other factors...
So the economic impact analysis is different whether you're looking at a Lucas taking or a non-categorical taking?
I believe it should be, Your Honor.
What case says that?
Well, I think the fact that Siena Good Gardens...
Now, apart from these cases, what case says
Roseacre.
That? What case?
Roseacre.
Roseacre didn't decide anything about models. Sent it back for the decision to be made by the trial judge.
Well, what Roseacre did, though, as Your Honor well knows, is that it rejected the United States' argument that use of the change in return on equity model as opposed to the change in value model was per se inconsistent with its takings jurisprudence. And when this court sent it back, it suggested that the return on equity model may be more appropriate in cases where you're talking about an ongoing business, a long-term taking of an ongoing business.
There was no holding about which method was required or in what circumstances.
I agree, Your Honor. But all I'm saying is
that this court rejected... Then it's not authority for anything.
Well, it was authority for rejecting the government's argument that in no circumstances can you use the return on equity model as opposed to the change in value model. The court quite clearly rejected that argument that the government made.
But we're not... No, that's not what we're talking about.
You all decide.
That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is whether in a temporary taking you have to consider the impact on the value of the property as a whole. Whether you calculate the lost income or the change in value or whatever it is, whether you can discard the consideration of the property as a whole. And the Court of Federal Claims here said, no, I'm not going to consider the value of the property as a whole. I'm only going to consider the impact during the period of the temporary taking.
And when it did
and
that,
what's the authority for that?
Well, as I said, when it did that, it was following this court's direction in Sandra Gardens. I'll
put that to one side. What
put
case?
That to the side for a moment. I don't think there is a case other than this line of cases in this court that has addressed the issue one way or the other, Your Honor, in terms of temporal takings. And I think when you look at the Supreme Court, first of all, in Penn Central itself, the court looked to return on equity as one of the measures. When you look at...
But it said you had to consider the value effect on the property as a whole.
Well, first of all, when
there's
it
case
that,
after case that says that under the... There's case after case, is there not, under the Penn Central analysis that says you have to consider the impact of the regulation on the property as a whole?
There is not a case in this court that has looked at the temporal aspect of takings and has said that you've got to look at the property as a whole temporally when you've got a partial regulatory takings. And the problem with doing that, and Judge Lynn, I think that you put your finger on it to some degree, is that if the government is right in this case, then they can take someone, they can go to a farmer and say, you can't grow any crops on your farm whatsoever for the next 20 years. And so long as the property is appreciated somewhat over that time period, that's okay. And the problem with
that's only one of the factors that has to be taken into account. Not the entire aspect of it. You still need to have some kind of an analysis.
I was about to address that, Your Honor, and I agree completely, because I think the problem with taking that approach, and we can take this case as an example, is, as this court found, what happened here was akin to a holdover tenancy by the government. The only distinction being, and I understand it's a distinction that matters for per se takings reasons, but the only distinction being, instead of the government moving its own personnel into these buildings, the government required the owners to house.
But this isn't a physical taking, it's a regulatory taking. And when the change in value approach considers not the appreciated value after the period of the temporal taking, it says at the point that the temporal taking took place, what was the value and what is the lost income compared to that value?
Your Honor, I don't think that that formulaic approach, if I may,
but it doesn't take account of the appreciation in the property, right? That approach to it does not deprive you of the value of the appreciation in the property over the time.
No, but the appreciation of the property wasn't realized during that period. And, Your Honor, if I may, as to three of these properties which signed use agreements, we don't yet know. For one of them, we can't know because it's sold under a use agreement. For the other two, the properties don't come out from under the use agreements until 2011, 2012. If you tried to take appreciation into account right now for those properties, I would suggest that what you're doing is counting paper gains that have happened during the last several years and telling the property holders you're charged as if you made those paper gains.
But that's not what the government's arguing. That's not what their evidence showed. They didn't take the value 20 years from now or 10 years from now after the temporary taking had concluded. They compared the property as a whole value at the time of the taking, which doesn't factor into it the appreciation. Correct?
Actually, it does, Your Honor, because whenever you're doing a property valuation at any time, when you're doing it on an income approach, what you're doing is you are discounting back.
You're not answering my question. You're not answering my question. When they made the comparison, it was the value of the property at the time that the restrictions were imposed, not the future value of the property. Correct?
No, Your Honor, I disagree with you.
What's your citation?
My citation, Your Honor, is understanding the method that they were using. When you're using a discounted cash flow method, what you're doing is you're predicting what the future cash flows are. You're discounting back to present value based on that, and you're determining the value of the property in that manner. To the extent you're doing that, you're making assumptions about the future cash flow of the property and, in turn, future value of the property. In terms of the sale process, if I may, just for a moment, the government argues that that you've got to take into account the sale option and that you've got to take into account the use agreement option when you are valuing economic impact. They've acknowledged that what you're talking about here is essentially cash flows provided by the government in either instance. In the sale option, they're saying it's a special sale we set up under the statute at a price nobody in the real market would pay for properties under these restrictions. And we're financing 95% of it. The use, as they've already said, they provide the money through Section 8 contracts. So what they're really saying is that if we provide cash to you while having taken away your property rights, you've got to take that cash into account as to whether the economic impact was great. And the problem with that was pointed out by Justice Scalia in his dissent in Pennell, where the majority didn't reach this issue, and also in his concurrence in Sweden with Justice O'Connor, where they said if you allow the government to do that, they can essentially offer partial compensation through the program itself and get away from the constitutional requirement to pay just compensation for the taking. So if you allow that, the government can always pay cents on the dollar as part of its program and avoid paying.
Yeah, but it might not be sufficient. It might be found to be too few cents on the dollar, and therefore there might be a taking. I don't think your argument goes where you say it goes.
Well, Your Honor, we certainly can say that if the government, let's suppose that the government pays 80 cents on the dollar, at least under its arguments, if it paid you 80 cents on the dollar as part of the taking, so it let's take an easy example. You can't use your farm for forever. Well, no, that would be you. You have to sell your the crops from your farm at cost forever.
No, but don't say forever. That's not this case. This okay, is a for, this is a case that involves a couple years of disputed 20, time.
20 years, Your Honor. 20 years of disputed time for three of these properties.
Well, maybe.
Well, for three of the properties, they signed use agreements which limited them until 2011 or 2012.
Well, in any event, your argument is that nothing the government gives should be weighed in the balance.
I wouldn't say that, Your Honor. I don't go quite that far. In Penn Central itself, there were transferable development rights. And
No. We're not. Let's not talk about Penn Central.
Okay.
In this case, under these regs and these statutes, in the second stage after the prepayment date, certain government benefits were available that were greater than those available before. And you seem to be saying, that doesn't matter, you're not allowed to take those into account, they don't cancel out anything by way of reduced rental rates. And I don't understand why they shouldn't.
Okay, well, I can explain, Your Honor.
What if the dollar amount is exactly equivalent? Suppose that I'm the owner, and listen to the hypothetical. I'm the owner, and I lose $100,000 in rental rates because I have to rent at below market rates under this program. And the government writes me a check for the equivalent amount. Under your analysis, it's still a taking.
It's been justly compensated, Your Honor. So there would be no cause of action. I mean, I'm not suggesting that it's...
Yeah, but I take it back. Under your analysis, it's still severe economic impact.
That's right, Your Honor. I think
that doesn't seem to make any sense, does it?
Well, I think if we take what the government had said earlier, that you look to see whether you've got the functional equivalent of a physical taking, then I would submit that if the government has regulatorily, let's say, taken away just about all the value of your property, but wrote you a check for 80% of it back, if you were going to compare the functional equivalent of a physical taking in the physical context, and I know physical is different, but in the physical context, the government can't get away with taking your property and writing you a check for 80% of it. And I would suggest that if the government has done the functional equivalent of physically taking it, the takings clause doesn't allow them to write a check for 60% or 80%. They've got to write a check for just compensation. And that is precisely what Justice Scalia was talking about. It's precisely what Judge Leto talked about. I'm not saying they don't get credit for it. What I'm saying is they can't cheat the takings analysis by providing
this
program.
But isn't it the fact that in this case Judge Leto didn't take into account any of the benefits that were part of the program in what I'm calling Stage 2?
Well, I'm not sure what Stage 2 is. It took into account
the post-prepayment date period.
In the post-prepayment date period, it said that whatever the government gave us in return was essentially partial compensation. It would be counted as compensation, but not in the economic impact.
Yeah, so the answer to my question is yes. Judge Leto excluded any consideration of the benefits of monetary value flowing to the landowners from HUD.
As this court did itself in Whitney Benefits, Your Honor. In Whitney Benefits, the government said, you can't mine the coal in your coal mine, but if you'd like, we've got an exchange program, and you can trade off your rights for mining in this coal mine for another mine.
Yeah, but that's not a situation in which the restrictions on the particular property were lifted. You know, that's what we have here, is that the government has created a program where there's a sale option, there's a use option, there's certain mitigation of the impact. And you're saying you can't take that into account in calculating economic impact.
Well, what I'm saying, Your Honor, is the government didn't give us back any of our property rights that were taken. If you look at the property rights that were taken, they were control of our property.
How can that be? There's a right to sale.
They gave us money.
Money? They didn't give you money under the sale option. Why?
Sure they did. As the government has just said, the government financed 95% of the sales. These were not fair market sales. This is not.
It said you can prepay the mortgage under certain circumstances if you go through this sale option. Why shouldn't the sale option be considered in determining economic impact?
Well, let's discuss what you could do, and I'd love to answer that question. The sale option was an option that if you chose it was going to take...
There was no consideration of the value of the sale option. It's totally ruled out in determining economic impact, right?
May I explain why not?
But
that's true.
Correct.
I agree.
Okay.
And the reason that you don't fairly take into account is what the government did is it provided a couple of options. Let's throw out the first one that we could prepay because everybody knows we couldn't. So you had the use agreement.
Well, that's not true. That's just not true. You could prepay if you exercise the sale option and there wasn't a purchaser, at the end of the process, if you couldn't make a fair market value sale, you could prepay.
After 3 years later, Your Honor, because we were in a low vacancy area, and the court so found when it was doing the ripeness analysis, because it found it would have been futile for us to request a prepay early on. So we know we're in a low vacancy area. We know if the sale didn't work, we'd have to wait an additional 3 years before we could prepay. I mean, sorry, before we could raise rents. So
you could prepay immediately, but there would be a three-year restriction on the ability to raise rents. All of that is ruled out. It's just not considered in the economic impact.
If I may explain why I think it was rational to do so, Your Honor.
Okay, go ahead.
All right. The government provided two options. One was a use agreement option. The other was a sale option. All right. You could only take one. I mean, in the end, you were only going to do one or the other. 76% of property owners took the use option, and the government has said in its post-trial briefs that's because it was the financially greatest option of the two. Right? If we were in a position today where we had taken the sale option, the sale hadn't worked out, we hadn't been able to prepay for raise our rents for 3 years, the government would be sitting here today saying, you should have chosen the use option. That was actually the better option, and we're going to charge you with having...
That's not the question. The question is whether the availability of the two options shouldn't be part of the analysis. You're saying no, and some of us are wondering if that really is a sensible approach.
And I understand that, Your Honor, and I do think that Whitney, with all due respect, I think that Whitney is not only a good comparison, but this case is further out than Whitney. In Whitney, where they were offering you another piece of property if you wanted to get rid of this, that one, that was restricted. In this case, they offered you cash.
Well, if that's the closest analogy that you can find in the case law, I don't think it's very close.
Well, Your Honor, I do believe that if the government is allowed to pay you partially in cash and get away, and by doing that, by paying you partial value in cash, get away from a taking, that is further along the line than offering you a property in return for a property. If you allow this, the government will forever be able to come in and say, we're going to regulate you, we're going to take away, in this case, of course, it was your right to control the property, your right, your contractual right to prepay, etc.
You're attributing to us that we're going to allow something. We're not taking any position in these questions about allowing something. The question that's being pursued by Judge Dyke and me and others is whether the full picture should be looked at by the trier of fact. And your position is no, only the lost income can be taken into consideration, and everything else falls outside the frame of the picture that's proper to consider. And people are questioning whether that's the best approach.
I didn't mean to imply anything different, Your Honor. I obviously don't know where this trip will come on.
Why is it that you are so resistant to allowing the finder of fact to look at things other than the lost rent?
Well, Your Honor, I guess all I can say is that as a matter of principle, I don't think that the United States should be able to offer you cash up front and that should count against whether there was a taking. I think in the end, if they owe you just compensation, they owe it to you. And the fact that they choose to pay some of it up front shouldn't even weigh in their favor. We're just trying to follow
the Supreme Court's orders from Penn Central that we have to measure the severity of the economic impact. We don't have any choice about that. We have to measure the severity of the economic impact. So then the question is, well, what do you look at in order to make that measurement? You're saying you only look at the lost rent. A different view is you look at the lost rent and some other things like the sale option, the use agreement option, long-term effects, possibly recouping the lost rent once the restriction is lifted. And then the property value may go up. I mean, it's a question of how tightly you limit the analysis and what you exclude from the analysis.
And, Your Honor, I understand that there can be a difference of view between you and I on that. As to the character of the taking, if I can move...
Why shouldn't the trial judge look at both your model and the government's model?
Because, Your Honor, I mean, obviously, if this court says it should, then it will. But I can't say it more than I have already, that in my view, it allows the government to cheat. It allows the government to pay part of the compensation up front rather than paying full. It may allow. That the government may be advantaged in paying part of the compensation up front, and that may allow it to escape paying full compensation in the end. And I really don't think that the timing of when the government pays you that compensation should change the fact that it owes you full compensation. I understand that this can be looked at differently, Your Honor, but that's the reason, and I think it's laid out very well by Justice Scalia in his separate opinions in Sweden and in the Pinnell.
That's a little bit like Whitney. You know, this is not a very close analog, and it's not even the majority opinion. If those are your strongest three authorities, a concurring opinion, a dissenting opinion, and a cold case with vastly different facts, I don't think you have a very pertinent authority at all.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that there's very pertinent authority going the other way either. I understand that you can reason from Penn Central and from Tau Sierra from large principles to try to get down to the government's position here, but it's not as though there's cases from this court that have looked at the issue and said...
I'm not trying to find a way to rationalize and support the government's position. I'm simply trying to find out what would a sensible decision maker want to look at in trying to determine what was the severity of the economic impact of the regulation, here, rent control.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that this is precisely like rent control as the government believes, and if I may answer that. The reason that this isn't precisely like rent control are a couple of differences. Number one, under rent control, ordinarily, you can convert...
I wasn't meaning to analogize it to rent, state rent control statutes. Reduced rent. Let's call it reduced rent, not rent control.
Okay. In terms of the character...
Russ, can I ask you a question?
Of course,
what do you understand, Mr. Dintzer's... I wasn't entirely clear. I asked him the question, assuming one accepts the return on equity approach, what errors did the court make in its application of that approach? What do you understand the government's contention to be in that regard?
Your Honor, it's very difficult to see exactly what their contentions are, and it's one of the things that we addressed in our brief, because in their post-trial brief, it's in a sentence or two in the whole post-trial brief, and what they're talking about there is they're saying that our expert, Mr. Pizer, considered certain factors when he was doing his damages analysis that he didn't consider when he was doing his economic impact analysis. I think principally they were talking about pay down of the mortgage, and they said that that was... That those should have been equivalent. That's all that's said in the post-trial brief about that. And now the only difference is that on appeal, they've tried to enlarge that a bit by saying that you should also take into account appreciation of the property.
What's your point? That by not being clearer or more emphatic or more lengthy in the post-trial brief, that somehow they've waived the right here to make this argument?
Actually, Your Honor, what I am saying is that I think you have to give the trial judge a fair shot at what your arguments are in the post-trial brief.
Well, you have to give a consequence. If you're saying that it was unfair to the trial judge because it was so quickly, lightly touched on, then something has to follow from that, and then the only thing I can think of that might follow from that is waiver. We shouldn't entertain that argument. They didn't
That's
give the trial
argument.
Judge. Okay,
That's
well then say
argument.
So. You know,
Sorry.
They waived the right to argue that here.
I think they waived it, and particularly.
Where did you make that argument in your brief?
Yes, we did.
Where?
Page 42.
Thank you, Your Honor. You're quicker than I am. The other thing I'd like to note, by the way, is...
What is the argument that they waived?
They waived the argument that other aspects of... what they waived the argument is that pay downs of equity or increases in equity that occurred during the time period should be taken into account in the change...
But you're not arguing that they didn't... raise the question about taking into account the sale option and the use option terms of the economic impact.
No, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I was answering Judge Shaw's question.
Now, my question was simply limited to if one accepts the return on equity approach, what errors do they say the judge employed
and
in that?
That's all that I was really trying to address is they've made a couple of slight arguments. We think it was a waiver, but in any event, certainly what they've talked about today, because today they brought up two new things that I've never heard of from them. I mean, one is that the Fannie Mae rate went down from 8.5% during the period the court should have taken that into account. That's not in the post-trial brief at all. It wasn't in the briefs here at all. That's certainly been waived. I mean, there's no question about that.
Well, it was a little different. It was a part of his argument that you would have to redo the calculations on an annual basis for the three-year period,
yes,
or whatever the period is.
And, you're right, and that was one of the things he said was wrong with how the judge did return on equity. And all I would suggest is that when they just said in one line, essentially, in the post-trial brief, you should have done it differently, I think what they had to do were a couple of things. First of all, they had to specify what they were talking about. You should have calculated that the Fannie Mae rate went down, because what the judge did is the judge took a static...
No, but his argument was that all the figures in the formula would be different one year to the next, and that therefore, to get an accurate computation, you'd have to use the differing numbers year by year by year.
Your Honor, first of all, he never said that to the district court judge, so I think it's fair for me to say that's waived. But secondly, all the formula numbers don't change. The numerator, which is 6% of initial equity, doesn't change during the period at all. And so the question is, did the denominator change? Did the equity and the property change? The current equity. And that's really the only other part of that
formula. Let me ask this. You would agree, would you not, that if one accepts either the return on equity approach or the change in value approach, or some other approach, but those are the two main ones that are under discussion, at least in the briefs, that the plaintiff has the burden of coming in with all of the things that have to be established under whichever approach is correct.
Unquestionably, Your Honor. I don't disagree with that. And in fact, if we look at what the court did, by the way, on remand in Roseacre, I thought it was sort of interesting, came out about a month ago. In response to Roseacre, what the court did is it used the change in equity approach, change in returns approach, but then it took a step back and it said, okay, but was this a significant amount of money? Was it a significant loss we're talking about? So in a sense, Your Honor, it really tried to take a look at both ways of thinking about it. What was the change in return on equity and did it matter? Was this a substantial financial loss?
When you say a month ago, I'm not
sorry, the,
clear
the remand,
on what you're
the decision on remand in Roseacre, which I thought was, when we're talking about potential hybrid approaches.
The trial court decision.
The trial court
There's
decision.
No further decision here.
Oh, no. But it's just when we're looking at potential hybrids that might take into account the special circumstances where you've taken 20 years of someone's earnings during their lifetime, but they might be able to get money back later. One other way of thinking about it would be using the return on equity approach during the period, but then taking that step back and saying, was this a serious financial loss? Wasn't it? And in a sense, Hodel, took an approach that wasn't much different than that. Hodel found that the character of the taking, given that what was taken was so integral and so long-standing a property right, was awfully important and weighed heavy in the analysis. And then it took a look at what the economic impact was, and essentially found that it was enough without getting into, a formulaic approach. And in this case, given that what we've got here really is analogous to a holdover, as this court has said before, that might well be an approach that this court might consider. Are there any further questions?
All right. Thank you, Mr. Brett.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Mr. Vinter, 5 minutes reserve rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Starting where, with respect to the fact that the trial court didn't consider these package of options in economic impact, I just want to make the point that the trial judge also expressly refused to consider them in the character of the government action, and that for the exact same reasons, when you're looking at what Congress did and why, obviously when it established this incredibly expensive scheme of paying out money and setting up a reduction of regulations, that should have been part of the trial court's consideration. With respect to the sale option, counsel said that there was a delay from the time of appraisal to the time of the sale. That actually benefited the plaintiffs because this was in a falling market. And as our expert said, he was speaking, and this is at Appendix A103621, he says, I'll tell you that given what happened in the marketplace, you'd be pleased this punch if you could get a 1990 or 1991 price for a property in 92 or 93. Question, what and why would that be? Answer, because the marketplace declined more than 50%. So
the government says that, your opponent says that you couldn't start this process until the regulations were issued. You agree with that?
The three of their plaintiffs were in Title II. They could have started the process in Title II and followed through in Title II. or they could have switched to Title VI. If they wanted to switch to Title VI, there would have been a delay while they waited for the regulation. But they could have gone through Title II and not had to wait for that. They had.
What does that mean?